Hawaii stands as a living laboratory of political and economic evolution. Sumner LaCroix's masterful analysis has captivated readers from Barack Obama to Warren Buffett, who called it the most illuminating historical analysis of island economics I've encountered. This book traces Hawaii's remarkable 800-year transformation from the last major landmass settled by humans into a complex modern state, revealing how its unique institutional development offers profound insights into how societies evolve. As the New York Times noted, LaCroix's work fundamentally reshapes our understanding of how political and economic systems interact across centuries of development. The settlement of Hawaii represents one of humanity's most remarkable achievements, the final chapter in our species' global expansion. Until recently, historians believed Polynesians had discovered Hawaii between 400 to 700 AD. Revolutionary archaeological techniques have dramatically revised this timeline, placing initial settlement between 1000 to 1260 AD, with evidence favoring the later part of this range. This compressed prehistory, just 500 to 700 years rather than 1,000-1,500, forces us to reconsider how rapidly Hawaii's population grew and how quickly its political structures developed. Even more astonishing, archaeological evidence reveals that Polynesians engaged in a remarkable pulse of exploratory voyages during the 13th century that reached all three vertices of the Polynesian Triangle almost simultaneously: Hawaii, 1200 to 1261, Rapa Nui Easter Island, 1200 to 1253, and New Zealand, 1230 to 1282. What motivated these dangerous voyages across thousands of miles of open ocean? Several factors likely influenced these decisions. The voyagers had accumulated sophisticated navigational knowledge and developed advanced double-hulled canoes capable of traveling 100 miles per day. Geographic features played a crucial role. Islands with tall volcanoes, like Hawaii, 13,600 plus feet, could be spotted from 50 to 150 miles away, unlike low-lying coral atolls visible only from nearby. Migratory birds like the golden plover, Kolea in Hawaiian, provided potential signals of northern lands, as their seasonal migration and healthy return suggested habitable lands existed to the north. Perhaps most importantly, potential voyagers would have known of Polynesia's spectacular 3,500-year record of discovering resource-rich islands, creating expectations that new discoveries would likewise sustain human life. The absence of first peoples in Hawaii meant settlers could devote resources to productive activities rather than conflict resolution, and could select optimal locations for settlement, particularly lands with superior water access for taro cultivation. The first voyagers to Hawaii were surely stunned when the 13,000-foot volcanoes of the Big Island appeared on the horizon, revealing 8 environmentally rich, unsettled subtropical islands. The earliest settlements likely concentrated on the windward coasts of Oahu and Kauai, whose environments were particularly suited to developing small ponded taro farms with manageable streams that could be diverted through carefully constructed terraces. The first voyagers to Hawaii were surely stunned when the 13,000-foot volcanoes of the Big Island appeared on the horizon, revealing 8 environmentally rich, unsettled subtropical islands. The earliest settlements likely concentrated on the windward coasts of Oahu and Kauai, whose environments were particularly suited to developing small ponded taro farms with manageable streams that could be diverted through carefully constructed terraces. Archaeological evidence reveals how early Hawaiian settlements rapidly transformed their environment. Sediment cores from ancient fish ponds show that prior to AD 922 to 1152 on Oahu's north shore and AD 1219 to 1403 in Kailua, a large percentage of plant pollen came from the lulu palm, a 30-foot-tall tree with edible nuts. After these periods, lulu pollen rapidly decreased, along with pollen from koa trees and native shrubs, indicating the disappearance of native forests as settlers cleared land for taro farms. This forest decline coincided with population crashes of native snails and flightless birds, like the astonishing goose and turtle-jawed goose. These birds, lacking natural predators, were likely harvested by settlers who also burned and cleared their habitats. The Polynesian rat, arriving as a stowaway on voyaging canoes, contributed significantly to the decline of Lulu palm forests by feeding on their nuts. Hawaii's population dynamics between settlement in AD 1260 and contact with Captain Cook's expedition in AD 1778 were remarkable. With an estimated population of at least 400,000 people by 1778, and considering the small initial settlement, Hawaii must have experienced extraordinary population growth. If the initial wave brought only 200 migrants with no additional arrivals, growing to 200,000 over 240 years would require a 2.88% annual population increase, a net total fertility rate exceeding 4 births for every adult female. Testing this against historical examples, the French population of Quebec grew from 12,000 in 1684 to 132,000 in 1784, with an annual growth rate of 2.4%. However, Hawaii's estimated growth rate is 18% higher and would have needed to persist for an additional 140 years, a scenario without historical precedent. The most plausible explanation involves substantial migration between 1260 to 1350, followed by declining but still high natural growth rates. By the 14th and 15th centuries, many Hawaiian farmers produced substantial agricultural surpluses beyond what they needed for themselves and dependents. The most productive lands were in mountain valleys, where streams could be diverted to irrigate taro farms. A typical ponded taro farm in Oahu's Anahuler district could generate an agricultural surplus of 50% of output, surpassing agricultural surpluses from most farmers in 19th century United States, France, England, or even pharaonic Egypt. These surpluses facilitated the formation of states throughout Hawaii during the 15th and early 16th centuries. Three key signals confirm Hawaii's substantial agricultural surpluses. First, the production of elaborate feathered capes and helmets for chiefs containing millions of feathers required feeding specialized bird catchers and artisans. Second, Hawaiians enjoyed considerable leisure time, particularly during the Makahiki New Year's Festival, engaging in numerous sports, including boxing, sledding, lawn bowling, and wrestling, activities a subsistence society could not afford. Third, the islands were covered with thousands of stone temples, heiau, including monumental structures requiring immense labor. During Hawaii's isolation period, its political systems evolved dramatically differently from other Polynesian societies, developing features more similar to the Aztec Empire, Wankan states of Peru, or Egyptian pharaonic dynasties. By the 15th century, Hawaiian society had developed a sharply differentiated elite, alii, whose social rank and privileges far exceeded those of the common people, kanaka maoli. When alii passed through villages, commoners had to lie face down or face execution. The divine connections of the alii were supported by state religion and elaborate genealogical systems denied to the general population. All Hawaiian states functioned as theocracies, with religious and state officials part of the same organization. A critical feature was the ritualized taxation system during the New Year's festival, Makahiki, which facilitated surplus extraction and war preparation. The integration of political authority with state religion led to the construction of thousands of stone altars, similar to archaic states in Central and South America. When Hawaii's isolation ended with Captain James Cook's arrival in 1778, its political order had evolved into a sophisticated system distinct from other Pacific societies. Small chiefdoms had been replaced by larger archaic states, each ruled by chiefs who commanded vastly superior status and wealth. These chiefs were supported by an elite class of specialized warriors, koa, who maintained military order, and prayer specialists, kahuna pule, who conducted religious ceremonies and preserved sacred knowledge. This hierarchical structure was deeply embedded in daily life through complex systems of kapu, sacred laws, that govern social interactions. The reintegration with foreign societies triggered profound and contradictory effects throughout the Hawaiian archipelago. Initially, it further centralized political authority when Kamehameha, strategically leveraging Western weapons, ships, and military advisors, launched a systematic campaign to unify all islands except Kauai and Niihau by 1795. He carefully redistributed conquered lands to five loyal ali'i supporters, creating a new political elite dependent on his patronage. However, this political consolidation coincided with devastating population decline among native Hawaiians, primarily due to introduced diseases like measles and influenza. This demographic collapse, combined with resource booms in sandalwood trading and whaling industries, fundamentally transformed the traditional relationship between ali'i, chiefs, and maka'ainana, commoners. To prevent rebellion and ensure political stability, Kamehameha devised an ingenious system of land distribution among his ruling coalition. Rather than granting chiefs administration rights to consolidated territories, he allocated scattered strips of land, ahupua, across multiple islands. These ahupua typically stretched from mountain to sea, providing chiefs with diverse resources but preventing them from establishing concentrated power bases. This arrangement made rebellion significantly costlier. A rebellious chief might gain lands on one island but would inevitably lose valuable holdings on others still under Kamehameha's control. This system of distributed land holdings became a cornerstone of Hawaiian political stability. The unified state's increased capacity to suppress rebellion gradually reduced its reliance on religious control, culminating in the dramatic abolition of the traditional state religion in 1819 under Kamehameha II. This religious transformation created a spiritual vacuum that Protestant missionaries quickly filled after their arrival in 1820. These missionaries established an extensive network of churches, developed a written form of the Hawaiian language, founded schools throughout the islands, and actively suppressed traditional cultural practices they deemed pagan. Their influence extended deeply into Hawaiian politics as they became trusted advisors to chiefs, held important government positions, and educated ali'i youth in Western concepts of governance and law. The missionary-established royal school, in particular, shaped the worldview of future Hawaiian monarchs, fundamentally altering how the kingdom would engage with the wider world in subsequent decades. The sandalwood trade created a striking Malthusian paradox in Hawaii. Despite a devastating population decline of 50 to 75% between 1778-1833, which traditional economic theory suggests should have increased wages and living standards as labor became increasingly scarce, historical records revealed deteriorating conditions for common people. This paradox emerged directly from the institutional changes following Kamehameha's unification of the Hawaiian Islands, transforming the archipelago's social and economic structure. Three interconnected factors explain this counterintuitive outcome. First, unification eliminated crucial exit options for maka'ainana, commoners, who previously could flee to competing chiefdoms when faced with excessive demands. This mobility had historically served as a check on chiefly power. Second, labor became exponentially more valuable as the sandalwood sector expanded, incentivizing rulers to establish stronger property rights over labor through new laws and enforcement mechanisms. Third, the threat of overthrowing local chiefs, which had previously constrained exploitative behavior, disappeared under Kamehameha's unified military power, removing another traditional check on authority. The sandalwood boom triggered widespread agricultural abandonment as workers were diverted to the mountains. Hawaiian historian Samuel Kamakau documented a severe famine in 1815 directly caused by this rush of labor. While Russian explorer Otto von Kotzebue and English traders in 1821 to 1822 recorded detailed accounts of thousands of workers forced into unpaid sandalwood harvesting while fertile fields remained untended. Communities were required to deliver specific quotas of sandalwood, leading to extended absences from traditional farming activities. Following Kamehameha's death in May 1819, his successor Liholiho implemented a significant policy shift by opening up the sandalwood trade to lesser chiefs, allowing them to negotiate independent deals with foreign traders. While the king maintained his share of revenues through taxation, he effectively lost control over the total quantity sold. This policy shift provided short-term political stability to his coalition, but created deeply problematic incentives. Chiefs with insecure property rights rushed to harvest even immature trees, leading to rapid resource depletion. The contrast between Kamehameha's and Liholiho's management of sandalwood revenues proved crucial for Hawaii's future. Kamehameha strategically invested proceeds in military equipment, ammunition, ships, and defensive structures, strengthening the kingdom's sovereignty. In contrast, Liholiho's supporters primarily channeled their newfound wealth into imported luxury goods like silk, fine china, and European furniture. The chief's lavish spending patterns extended to borrowing heavily against future sandalwood shipments, with each chief rationally prioritizing immediate consumption over uncertain future income. This short-term thinking ignored the collective danger that mounting foreign debts posed to Hawaiian independence, setting the stage for increasing foreign influence and economic vulnerability in the decades to follow. From the 1830s through the 1850s, Hawaii underwent a profound transformation of its indigenous institutions to incorporate Western concepts of representation, property rights, and individual liberties. This evolution from a basic to a mature natural state was catalyzed by multiple factors: increasing encounters with global powers, devastating population decline from introduced diseases, and deepening integration into international trade networks, particularly through the whaling industry and emerging agricultural exports. The Mahele, Hawaii's revolutionary land reorganization program of the 1840s-1850s, represented the most significant transformation of traditional Hawaiian society, converting ancient customary land rights into a Western-style private property system. Interior Minister Garrett P. Judd, an American missionary turned advisor, proposed this conversion in 1845, leading to the establishment of a land commission tasked with investigating and awarding land titles. The Privy Council, under King Kamehameha III, adopted comprehensive rules in December 1847 that divided lands among four major categories: the king's personal holdings, government lands, chiefs' konohiki lands, and commoners' makaaina parcels. By March 1848, 245 high-ranking landlords had negotiated their divisions with the king, a process that required careful documentation and often complex negotiations. The day after completing these arrangements, Kamehameha III divided his personal holdings into government lands for public administration and crown lands, his private property. Many chiefs subsequently surrendered significant portions of their awarded lands to the government as commutation fees, receiving fee simple titles for their remaining holdings, a process that introduced them to Western concepts of land mortgages and sales. The final division of land revealed stark inequalities. Approximately 984,000 acres became crown lands, 1,619,000 acres went to chiefs, 1,495,000 acres became government lands, while only 28,600 acres were distributed as kuleana lands to common Hawaiians. This dramatic disparity stemmed from multiple factors: political influence of chiefs, complex application procedures that disadvantaged commoners, insufficient surveying expertise, widespread confusion about the new system, and many natives' reluctance to file claims, viewing land ownership as contrary to traditional values. These sweeping political reforms and the transition to private property created ideal conditions for sugar plantations, which quickly became the island's dominant economic force. However, the plantation system's intense labor demands confronted a catastrophic decline in the native Hawaiian population, which fell by over 50% between 1831 to 1866 due to introduced diseases. The government's solution, allowing planters to import contract laborers, began with Chinese workers and later expanded to Japanese immigrants, fundamentally reshaping Hawaii's demographic composition. This shift in population dynamics contributed significantly to both the 1893 overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy and the subsequent diminishment of native Hawaiian political influence under American rule, as immigrant laborers and their descendants gained increasing economic and political power. The Mahele's long-term consequences continue to influence modern Hawaii, particularly in ongoing debates about land rights, sovereignty, and cultural preservation, making it a pivotal moment in Hawaiian history that transformed not just property relations, but the entire social fabric of the islands. The 1876 Reciprocity Treaty fundamentally altered Hawaii's economic and political trajectory. After two failed attempts at reciprocity treaties in 1855 and 1867, the U.S. finally ratified an agreement in 1876 that eliminated tariffs on Hawaiian sugar exports to America. Strategic considerations drove American support for the treaty. The U.S. viewed the Pacific as an American ocean and Hawaii as a crucial midpoint for commerce with Asia. The treaty included a clause preventing Hawaii from leasing ports or territories to other foreign powers. Economic analysis confirms the treaty primarily benefited Hawaiian sugar producers, who received a 20-40% price premium. The treaty created trade diversion, where Hawaiian exports replaced those from lower-cost producers like Cuba. U.S. consumers saw no price reductions, while the U.S. government lost all tariff revenues on Hawaiian sugar. This explains why America demanded compensation through the treaty's strategic provisions limiting foreign influence in Hawaii. The sugar industry's explosive growth after the Reciprocity Treaty vindicated treaty opponents' concerns. Sugar exports to America skyrocketed from 21 million pounds in 1876 to 224.5 million pounds by 1890. Acreage devoted to sugar production increased more than tenfold in just two decades, from 8,500 acres in 1870 to 87,016 acres by 1890. By 1883, opposition to the Reciprocity Treaty had mounted in the United States. When the treaty was extended for 7 years in December 1884, the U.S. Senate attached a critical amendment demanding exclusive rights to Pearl Harbor as a naval station. This amendment allowed the U.S. to improve the entrance to said harbor and do all other things needful. The monarchy's 1893 overthrow, the central event in Hawaii's 800-year history, had its foundations in the 1887 Bayonet Constitution. While immediately triggered by treaty renegotiations, deeper forces included rising U.S. imperial interests. The 1890 McKinley Tariff eliminated sugar tariffs, plunging Hawaii's economy into depression and creating political crises for Queen Liliuokalani. When she signaled willingness to reduce foreign influence, a small group of foreigners, with U.S. Minister John L. Stevens' assistance and U.S. Marines, staged a coup. The 1900 Organic Act marked a pivotal shift in Hawaii's governance, establishing a territorial government with power heavily concentrated in the U.S. president's hands. This arrangement gave the president authority to appoint both the governor and Supreme Court justices, creating a top-down colonial administration that would persist for nearly six decades. The territorial government wielded extensive executive powers, strategically distributing economic benefits to a dominant coalition comprised of U.S. military interests, the Big Five sugar corporations, Castle and Cook, Alexander and Baldwin, C. Brewer & Co., American Factors, and Theo H. Davies, and Hawaiian Caucasian voters who formed the territory's political elite. Hawaii's American colonial experience lasted 61 years, relatively brief when compared to other colonial territories like the Philippines, which endured 375 years of combined Spanish and American rule. This shorter colonial period may have contributed significantly to Hawaii's robust economic performance after achieving statehood. However, it's important to note that Hawaii had already implemented many Western governance institutions, including British common law, during the monarchy period, 50 to 60 years before formal American colonization. This pre-existing institutional framework provided a foundation for later development. The concentration of territorial government power in Washington, D.C. sparked growing advocacy for statehood among various Hawaiian groups. These advocates saw statehood as a path to establish sovereign state government and transition from the restrictive colonial rule to an open-access political order. Prince Jonah Kuyo Kalanianaonole, Hawaii's non-voting delegate to Congress, took a significant step by introducing a statehood bill in 1921. However, congressional resistance would delay passage for nearly three decades. Support for statehood intensified during the 1940s-50s, particularly driven by two factors: bitter memories of absolute U.S. military rule during World War II, when civilian government was suspended, and widespread frustration with the territorial government's inadequate provision of public goods and services. The achievement of statehood in 1959 ushered in dramatic institutional changes that fundamentally restructured Hawaii's political landscape. These changes included the popular election of the governor, replacing presidential appointment, gubernatorial authority to appoint judges, increasing local control over the judiciary, removal of federal checks on the legislature's authority, and full congressional representation with voting rights. These reforms marked a swift and comprehensive transition from a limited-access colonial system to an open-access political order. The subsequent 15 years saw equally transformative policy changes that reshaped Hawaii's social and economic fabric. Mandatory employer-paid health insurance for full-time workers, the first such law in the nation, significantly expanded K-12 education funding, major university system expansion, implementation of strict antitrust legislation to promote competition, and massive infrastructure investment in roads, airports, and public facilities. These changes demonstrated the profound impact of institutional reform on public policy and economic development. Hawaii has overcome some aspects of its colonial legacy, but struggles with others. Its early experience with centralized government, avoidance of slave labor, and the relatively short duration of U.S. colonial rule helped it escape deeper colonial problems. However, in its 60 years of statehood, Hawaii has only partially succeeded in addressing uncompensated land transfers and the suppression of Hawaiian cultural practices and language. Colonial legacies persist in Hawaii today, manifested in the lower incomes of Native Hawaiians and their loss of crown lands and sovereign government. These issues have sparked ongoing debates about governance and land rights. The Crown lands question follows a historical pattern of land redistribution by ruling powers, but differs because it occurred after private property rights had been established through the mahele. The 1978 Constitutional Convention created the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, OHA, which receives 20% of revenues from public land trusts, though disputes over this allocation have continued. The 1993 congressional apology for the overthrow acknowledged U.S. involvement but didn't fundamentally change policy. When OHA challenged a state land transfer, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that the apology resolution didn't restrict Hawaii's authority over these lands. The voyagers who settled Hawaii in the 13th and 14th centuries established independent settlements that evolved into rich, unique political institutions over centuries of isolation. Competition among archaic states drove expansion of production and population. When Hawaii reintegrated with the world in the late 18th century, a unified Hawaiian nation emerged, gaining international recognition and successfully modernizing while preserving independence and culture. American colonial rule interrupted over 600 years of Hawaiian independence, yet paradoxically contained the seeds of its own destruction. The political organizations established during this period ultimately undermined colonial order, leading to more open political structures. However, these failed to adequately address Hawaiian land confiscations and sovereignty laws. The state's future as a multicultural open society depends on whether Native Hawaiians and state and federal governments can find new mechanisms to redress these historical injustices and the lost sovereignty of Native Hawaiians.